sign up today for the Film Comment Letter. It's a free weekly digital newsletter featuring original film criticism and writing by Film Comment's editors and brilliant contributors.
The letter delivers exclusive features, reviews, interviews, streaming picks, news, and more directly to subscribers' inboxes before they're published on filmcomment.com the following Monday.
Sign up today at filmcomment.com. Welcome to the Film Comment podcast. I'm Devika Girish, the editor of Film Comment. Last fall, I saw Bertrand Bonello's new film, The Beast, in an IMAX theater in Toronto. And I left truly shaken and thrilled by it. It's a loose 2.5 hour time and space jumping adaptation of Henry James's famous novella, The Beast in the Jungle, in which a man refuses love, believing that he's destined for a catastrophe. In The Beast, a woman, Gabrielle, played by Léa Seydoux, is thwarted in her quest for romance with Louis, played by George MacKay, in three different eras by various catastrophes. In 1910, the Great Flood of Paris gets in their way. In 2014, it's incel culture. And in 2044, it's a world taken over by artificial intelligence where people are purified of their traumatic memories that spells doom for love. It's an unpredictable and expansive film that brings together references from literature, art, cinema, and internet culture into a movie that feels classical and at the same time extremely contemporary. A true portrait of what it feels like to be alive today. And boy, is it creepy. The Beast opens in theaters on Friday, so on today's podcast, I was joined by Bertrand Bonello to talk about the film. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Bertrand, it's such a pleasure to have you on the Film Comment podcast. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Where are you joining me from? I see that you are in a room of some sort, and I see that there's a doll with a cigarette in its mouth, and I believe that doll is seen in the film.
And you're totally right. It's Cindy. It's my adoptive daughter.
Yeah,
she's a doll that... There is dolls everywhere in the film in 1910, in 2014 and 2044. This is behind me, the one in 2014.
Yeah, so what is the significance of that particular doll?
Well, dolls are running through all the film, through the periods. In 1910, Gabrielle's husband has a dolls factory, and... It has a real strong meaning in the script. And in 2044, we have almost a human doll played by Guslaji Malandau. And it's just a way also to have a construction in everything. The characters, but the clairvoyance that you can see in both periods and pigeons. And all these kind of little signs that rings bells, you know, from one period to another.
Yeah, when I was rewatching the film to prepare for this recording, you know, there are many images that are very iconic in a way in the film. And one that really stuck with me on the second watch is when, you know, George MacKay's character and Léa Seydoux's character, they're in the first section, 1910, they're in this doll factory. The flood is coming. He says, if you don't see me in 2 minutes, start swimming. And in the back, the dolls are melting. These plastic dolls are melting in the fire. And the melting of the dolls I found to be such an evocative image for the film.
All this scene was obviously like the most difficult to do because you have water, you have fire, you have real actors. Everything is done live. You know, there's no special effects.
Wow. Okay. That I was going to ask you if that involved VFX.
No. It's all live. So it was really dangerous and tough, but we were very happy with the result. And yes, of course, the melting of a doll, it's like a destruction of a face. It's like a symbol of something that is burning, like love burning and dying at the same time.
So I actually did want to start, you know, talking about this melting of a face with the prologue of the film, the green screen, which then kind of distorts. And I mean, I found that such an incredible prologue, you know, something that really frames the film in a fantastic way, because it is this performing the fear for something that isn't there, which is how a lot of modern filmmaking works, you know, VFX works, you know, acting in response to something that isn't there. But it also relates to the theme of the Henry James story, this you constantly fear something that isn't there. So if you could talk a little bit about that opening scene, why you wanted to start with it, and also just your, I'm curious about your thoughts about green screen.
Well, actually, it's the first scene I wrote. You know, I started by writing this scene. I was sure it's going to be the opening of the film. I'm sure this will be in the end editing. For me, there are three reasons. First of all, for everyone in the world, the green screen is related to virtuality. So for the audience, if you start a film like that, they're going to know that there's going to be some virtuality in the film. That if you open with 1910, it looks like a period film. If you have the green screen before, it's a little weirder than that. And then when you open with that, when you arrive in 1910, the scene is loaded, you know, by the scream, by everything that's been said about the beast and everything. The third reason is that, I don't know, the scene might be like 2 minutes and a half or something. You have just one actress alone in this kind of green ocean. And it's also a way to say, well, the subject of my film, it's Gabrielle. And even more, the subject of my film is Léa Seydoux. It's going to be her.
Is there a reason? So you said that you, in the doll, in the 1910s part, in the doll factory, the flood, the fire, you said that does not involve VFX. Why is that? Where, even though VFX is clearly a subject of the film in a way.
Oh, because for all these kind of scenes, I guess, I think that everything you can do on the set is better than everything you can do on post-production. So I try to do as more as I can on set.
But in the, from what I read in the press notes, in the 2044 section, you did use special effects to kind of get that dystopian Paris.
Yes, because I took basically Paris as it is, because it's only in 20 years. And instead of adding many stuff, technological stuff, I took away, you know, I emptied everything. So we had to erase the cars and the commercial stuff, because in 2044, in my future, there is no more cars, no more internet, no more commercials. So yeah, this we had to use erasing by special effects. Yes.
Going back to kind of the genesis of the film, you said the scene with the green screen was the first you wrote. I'm kind of curious, what was the seed of the film for you? Because it is such an expansive film. It brings together so many different time periods and ideas and references also. What for you was the kernel for this film?
I think, and that comes from Henry James, the mix of the two feelings of fear and love, you know, and to push them as far as I could. So to push them also by mixing different genres, different periods, melodrama and slasher and science fiction, you know, but everything is really how you can have some love in a slasher and some fear in a melodrama, and to really push these two feelings, which are for me like two feelings that make you feel alive.
I was thinking about the fear, so which is such a big part of the film. And for me, when I first saw the film, I thought it was this kind of deconstructed horror. There was something about it, you know, it's horror, but instead of, again, it's more about the fear than the monster. You know, horror films are usually, yeah, you see the monster and then people are reacting to that. But here you don't see the monster, but you feel the fear.
That comes a lot from Henry James, because the beast thing, you know, they do not know what the beast is. You know, you have like the feeling that something is going to come. And this is fantastic in the novel, you know, because it gives so much space for the unseen.
And that is in the novel, it's an early 20th century kind of take on that feeling, and it has to do with romanticism and ideas about fate. But you transpose that into a present where I think it takes on a kind of different meaning. I think it captures the world in which we live, which is controlled by things we do not see. You know, I was thinking, I don't know if you read the theorist Mark Fisher. He has this concept of what is eerie. And what is eerie is the absence of presence, or the presence of absence, as he calls it. And he says that it's very much a condition of the capitalist world where you are being controlled by things you cannot see. So you feel this lack of agency. And I really was thinking how your film, and even actually Coma to some extent, capture that sense of eerie, this constant fear that I think is a condition of our present, where there are invisible forces all the time, but we also have this illusion of agency, you know, of complete freedom and choice. And that creates this sense of hopelessness.
No, you're totally right. One of our biggest fears today is what we do not see. And for example, AI is one of these things, you know, technology, relationship between technology and humanity, which is a really strong subject nowadays, and more than subject, fear, you know. And actually, I think the novel of Henry James is even more contemporary now than it used to be, because it rings so many bells on many things, you know, exactly on what you said.
So formally, you know, I'm struck by how the film captures that fear of the unseen formally. You know, you have these shots where the point of view of the camera isn't clear. And sometimes you think you're watching from Gabrielle's point of view, but then you see her. Can you talk a little bit about the formal decisions you took to kind of capture that atmosphere of eeriness, of the fear of the unseen?
Well, most of the answers come from problems or questions, you know. For example, in 2014, you have like a young woman alone in a house in front of a computer and someone outside. So how do you create attention with that? You know, it's something you've seen a lot of times. You have to create, to invent. And so it comes from, you know, problems, in fact, you know. In 1910, I really wanted something very central. So we used 35 millimeters, very slow movements, you know, like caresses the characters in a way, you know. And 2044, I wanted something, you know, that even if the concept is that there is no more problem because everything has been solved, I wanted to create like a tough atmosphere, you know, something where characters are really, really alone. You know, we don't even have relationships. If you talk to a friend, it's just a voice. There's no body. And we went back to a square ratio instead of 1:85, you know, like if the present was without air and the past were the kind of refugee, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little more about the 2014 section, especially the sequence where Gabrielle is in the house and George McKay's character is invading. So it's a home invasion sequence, which is a classic of horror cinema. Can you talk about developing that sequence and also shooting it? I think it's kind of one of the most remarkable sequences in the movie. And there's a kind of choreography to it.
Yes, it's the perfect word, choreography. As I told you, it's something quite classical and you have to invent little stuff. And one woman alone, you know, how do you shoot that? So you have to find a lot of ideas. And I really wanted the house to be with a lot of windows, because at the same time, she's alone. At the same time, she's never invisible. You know, everyone is watching her, like the neighbors that calls the owner in Europe. And she has all these phone calls, you know, and it's her body is always in movement and trapped at the same time. And that's why the word you use, choreography, is the perfect one. Yes.
And how was it like to shoot that sequence?
It was hell.
Yeah.
No, hell for us because there are so many windows, you know, that the reflections, you know, it's so hell to find. No one was on the set except the camera girl, you know, hidden in a black clothes. For the actors, I mean, it's tough because for Léa, playing mostly in front of a computer, you know, it's difficult, you know, say you don't have a partner, you know, so was not so easy. And it's in the editing room we really found, you know, how to create the tension on these scenes.
And obviously, a big part of the 2014 section is the incel video, where George, his character, is basically recreating this real video, uploaded by this famous kind of incel murderer, Elliot Rodgers, in 2014, before he committed, a mass shooting. I was curious what, how you found that video, why you decided you wanted to recreate it, sort of what you see as its place in the film.
In fact, 10 years ago, when I saw these videos, I was really, really impressed. They really shocked me. Besides the fact that after that he killed some girls, just the videos itself really impressed me because the tone of the voice, the words he used, there is something so calm. There's nothing crazy. It's not like Jack Nicholson in Shining, you know. And this calm and this choice of the words really impressed me, and I kept that in my mind. Then when I constructing the story, for me, 1910, Gabriel is the one that has the fear of love, and I wanted to swap that in a more contemporary period. So for me, a way of thinking about the incels is maybe also the fear of love, but it's something that it's unconscious for them. You know, they do not realize that. They don't say, "I'm fear of falling in love, so I'm gonna be alone." You know, it's the girl don't want me, so I hate them, so I'm gonna kill them. But what she sees in him, it's not a psychopath. She sees someone that is not able to say the words, "I am afraid of falling in love." You know, and I thought it was a great contemporary character to talk about the fear of love.
And is there a reason that you wanted to, recreate that video? I mean, is it correct that his lines are actually exactly lifted from the transcript of the video, more or
Yes,
less?
it is. There is only one that I wrote myself because it's more related to the story. Otherwise, yes, because I couldn't write it better.
And what was it like for George MacKay to prepare for that particular scene? I mean, what did you sort of, how did you prepare him for it?
Well, George is someone that loves to prepare a lot. So, I don't know, maybe 2 months before the shoot, he sent like long emails asking many, many questions. And what do you mean by this line? And this in this scene, it's really this or that. You know, he needs a lot of preparation. Then he disappears, and he had to learn French because he didn't speak a word of French. Then he disappears and works by, you know. But he has everything in mind, and we had the discussion before. So it's exactly the same for the American part, you know. I guess he watched some videos. He changed, of course, his accent and created a new character, you know.
Why actually, why is that part set in LA? Why did you choose to have that middle portion take place in Los Angeles?
I think because on the original videos it's LA, and I had this images. It had to be in America for me, you know.
Yeah. Why is that?
Because I think, of course, you have incels everywhere in the world. Of course, you have psychopaths everywhere in the world. But this way of putting yourself in video, this way of acting that is like a kind of product of American culture for me. But maybe because I'm coming from, you know, a real videos, you know. So I couldn't imagine something in another country. And Los Angeles, I don't know, because there is something very cinematic, very quickly, you know. It brings you back to so many images.
These scenes we see on the street in Los Angeles, we only are outdoors very briefly in the LA scenes. They have this eerie emptiness that is very similar to the Paris scenes later in the film. You know, you don't see that many people. It's kind of very vast and vacant looking. But was that also a choice, or is that just how it was over there?
No, that's just how it was. We didn't choose a lot. You know, it's just like it was a very small shoot in LA. We just stayed like 2 nights. The rest of the film is the American scenes are shot in the south of France. So no, it's just chance.
And the LA portion is also, you know, some of the best parts of that are kind of depicting the lives of actresses. You know, Gabrielle goes to these auditions and is talking to another actress about how to make a living. And you said earlier that it was important for you with the green screen prologue to be clear that this is a movie about the character, but also about the actress. Mm-hmm. Why is that theme important in the film, this of the life of an actress?
Well, she's in 1910, she's a musician. In 2014, she's an actress. I wanted like, yes, yeah, so kind of, well, she's a great pianist in 1910 and like not so great actress in 2014. But kind of relationship with your own image, you know? And an actress is conscious of her image. It's about the image, yes.
I was wondering if it also had something to do with what you've called in the press notes, the history of feelings, how the movie is about the history of feelings and these three ways in which in 1910, feelings are expressed, then feelings are repressed and suppressed. And I was just thinking how acting relates to that history. You know, acting is very much a performance of feelings, and I was curious where acting fit into that kind of progression for you.
In fact, you can see that very much on George, much more than Leah, because it's very different according to the three periods. And in fact, the character of Gabrielle, she's the same. She changes because period changed. But her, inside her, she's exactly the same. She's seeking for the same thing from the beginning to the end, from the green screen to the screen.
And you can see what more in George's character, do you think?
The differences. The differences. This expression of feelings in 1910, he really talks about that, using sometimes music, you know, as a metaphor. The repressed thing in his videos, and the suppressed thing, suppressed feelings at the end of the film.
Why do you think Leah's character, Gabrielle, does not go through all the changes?
Because I think she's searching always for the same thing, whatever the periods.
Which is love?
She doesn't know yet, but yes.
So it is kind of the opposite of the Henry James novel, where he's avoiding something he doesn't know, and he or she is constantly searching something she doesn't know.
Yeah, I swap the characters.
And do you think that something, the fact that you also swap the gender adds a different dimension? The fact that here the protagonist is the woman?
Maybe it gives something more contemporary to the film. I really wanted to swap also because I've never done like a film with a female character as the center of the film, you know.
Coma.
There are two. You know, there are two main lead roles, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And like House of Pleasure, it's six, you know, but just one. It's the first time, and I really wanted that.
And I mean, how was that different in terms of writing or shooting from?
No difference. No difference. I mean, it's always me, you know. And for example, on the set, when Leah didn't know how to act something, she said, well, anyway, Gabrielle, it's you. So come on, do it. And you know her better than me. Do it and I will imitate you.
Really? So you would perform it and then she would emulate you?
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, wow. Interesting. So, you know, I brought up Coma, and I did want to ask a little bit about whether the making of Coma in any way influenced this film, because I see a lot of resonances in the two. You know, one is that sense of fear, but also the way you use digital artifacts. You know, Coma has this combination of digital internet artifacts, and they appear in this film in some really interesting ways. The fortune teller scene, the terror of the spam, the terror of like pop-up spam. And you also have, I mean, you have a reference to trash humpers at one point, you know, on the laptop that Leah is watching, the Elliot Rodgers video.
The serial killers, yes, sure. No, in fact, we were ready to shoot the Beast like in 21, but we had some problems with Leah Seydoux's schedule, you know, and we had to postpone the film from 1 year. So I had like an empty year, and the producer told me like, "Oh, make a short movie." Or I say, "No, I'm going to make a feature, but with the budget of a short movie." So of course, The Beast was ready in my head, and Coma is like, of course, there's a lot of relationships. I tried some stuff. It's not on the subject, you know. It's more formal, you know. But the films are very related.
Do you spend a lot of time on the internet?
Not that much, no.
Where do you find these references from then, like this, the YouTube videos? And I mean, Coma so fantastically and accurately recreated the experience of being lost on the internet. You know, where does that come from?
Well, I don't think you need to get lost on the internet to write about getting lost on the internet. And Patricia Coma, the YouTube girl, I don't go on YouTube channels, but I'm not sure she's like very realistic. She's out of age, out of, you know, but it comes from my imagination.
And I did want to ask a little bit about, you know, why Trash Humpers is cited, I guess, in the movie. Is that do you like Harmony's work a lot, or did you think it was like just a perfect encapsulation?
No, I really like Harmony's work, but it's not just for that or for an homage. It's a sequence with pop-ups, you know, and so I was trying to find images that in 2 seconds gives you like something really insane, an image very insane, and is, I don't know how, so good at that, to create in 2 seconds an insane image. I don't know what's in his brain. I don't want to know. I don't want to live there. But he has this huge talent.
Did you talk to him before including that? Did he know that you were going to?
No, I don't think so. We only met once a long time ago.
And does he know now that the Trash Humpers
is in the
movie?
You don't know.
And I know that Xavier Dolan also appears in the movie as a voice actor, and he's also a producer on the film. Can you talk about that? You know, his cameo.
I know Xavier for a long time, and his producer Nancy Grant also for a long time, and they wanted to work with me since many years, and we needed a co-production for this film because it was too big to be only French. So I asked them, you know, and they say sure. So it's the film is like, I don't know, like 10% Canadian, and Xavier wanted to be part of it in a way or another. You know, it's like a small friendship than something else. It's just a voice. He's like the AI, in fact, you know, it's like the entity of AI. And there is a lot of talking between Leah and him. And but I like what he does. He's good.
And then also I was very pleased to see Guzlagi Malanda in the film, who I saw in Say No More. And, yeah. And she has a very arresting face.
She is fantastic. I mean, when I met her at first, you know, I didn't see Saint-Omer because I was before. She rang at my door. I opened the door, and I knew I would hire her. You know, I did some acting tests because, you know, it's like, but there is something so strong, so intense, and it's incredible.
And what about the process of casting Leah? You know, when did you know that she would be the right fit for the role?
While writing.
Yeah.
Yes, because she's the only French actress that could be good in the three periods for me, because she's timeless. She's at the same time very modern and she's timeless, you know. And also, the more I was writing, the more I knew I would need this kind of mystery. And she has a huge mystery. Even if the camera looks at her for like 2 hours and 25 minutes, there is something, you know, she's stronger than the camera in a way.
Wow, that's a very nice way of putting it. I'm also curious if there are other films or filmmakers that you were thinking about while making this movie. People in watching the film have brought up Lynch and Cronenberg and many other touch points. I'm curious if what was on your mind while making it.
Yeah, I've read that a lot. It's two directors that I love. So in a way, they probably come out in a way and another. But I watched two films before shooting. One of them was The Age of Innocence. Yes. And another one is a film called, in English, it's When a Stranger Calls. Fred Walton, end of the 70s, you know, with Carol Kane, alone in a house, and the telephone rings. Have you checked the children?
Okay, so those were the two. That's interesting. And for the so those make sense for the first and second part of the film. For the dystopia, what was on your mind?
For the dystopia, I mean, all the films I could think of about science fiction, about the future, they're all either they go in the hyper technology way, either the post-apocalyptic way, you know. So I wanted to find a third way of showing the future. So I was more influenced by pictures in contemporary art than films, you know. Yeah, it's not films that influenced me.
There's, you know, this film is also such a, like, a compendium of genre cinema in a way. What is sort of your interest in genre? Can you talk about that? Like, what does genre cinema allow you to do?
Well, I think it's my interest in watching movies. It's beginning of the 80s and all these amazing directors like Romero, Argento, Cronenberg, Carpenter, and Tobe Hooper and many, many others. And I think it's making a film of fear is a way of talking about your own fear of the world. When they're done in first degree, you know, which were their case. They're very serious when they make these films, you know. Something that has been lost a little after that, when it becomes more like commercial films just for fun, you know. But if you are like serious with a genre movie, you talk about your own fear, you know.
I also wanted to ask about the QR code at the end of the film. And this is sort of what I love about the film is this highbrow, lowbrow, but also classical cinema and then just extremely contemporary internet and digital and virtual aspects that you just bring together.
Well, no, this is the most beautiful compliment, saying this is classical, because classical for me is something very difficult to make, you know. It's not, and that gets contemporary, you know. How classic could be contemporary? I put a QR code because it fits with the end of the film. It's so it talks about the loss of humanity in a way, you know, and you don't have enough even the names anymore, you know.
Like depersonalized, yeah. I think I'm pretty much out of time, so thank you again so much for your time, Bertrand. Well, maybe before we wrap up, what has surprised you about how audiences have responded to The Beast so far? And what are you kind of looking forward to now that the film's opening in America?
Well, so long I've been very, very surprised by the amazing critics. They were like I've never had before. And I am expecting people to be like if they made a trip, you know, a trip full of cinematic emotions.
Lovely. on that note, we'll wrap it up here. Thank you so much. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and we're excited to welcome you in New York soon.
Thank you, Deepika.
The Film Comment podcast features original music by Greg Einge. Film Comment is a publication of Film at Lincoln Center. Since 1962, Film Comment has been the home of independent film journalism, publishing in-depth interviews, critical analysis, and feature coverage of mainstream, arthouse, and avant-garde filmmaking from around the world. Visit us online at filmcomment.com.